23 tested, with 228 pending, 60 deaths. Recovered, 3,021. Active, 733. Midland County, 2,888 confirmed cases, with 60 deaths. From the Texas Tribune, Texas has averaged more than 200 COVID-19 deaths a day for almost 3 weeks. 6,210 Texans are in the hospital for the coronavirus as of August 18th, 1,006 less than a week ago. They occupy 11.4% of hospital beds. 7,282 new cases were reported on August 18th. There were 24,478 molecular tests reported on August 17th. That made the positivity rate 11.2%. 10,250 Texans have died as of August 18th. 216 more deaths reported than the day before and 1,540 more than a week ago. West Texas Intermediate is trading at $42.55, down 34 cents. And now here's the first of the longer articles we'll be bringing you. These are going to be today read from the New York Times. A novel way to combat COVID-19 in nursing homes, strike teams. Borrowing from a model used for natural disasters, states are sending teams of responders to help facilities with outbreaks. Hendersonville, North Carolina. The coronavirus entered Cherry Springs Village quietly, then struck with force. Nearly every staff member and resident of the long-term care facility would become infected. They needed help, fast, and the county responded. It sent in a strike team of medical workers, emergency responders, clergy, and others, in what is becoming a new model for combating COVID-19 in residential care centers. Nurses and doctors from hours away came to aid sick residents and replace staff who had contracted the virus. They set up oxygen and IV drips to avoid sending residents with milder illness to overburdened hospitals. Members of the county's emergency management department conducted rapid testing of all staff and residents. The Henderson County Rescue Squad, a volunteer paramedic group, erected decontamination tents outside for staff to safely remove protective gowns, masks, and other equipment after shifts, and educated them on the proper use and removal of the garments. Chaplains and therapists came from a nearby hospice to provide emotional support to families and staff, who sometimes witnessed several residents die in one day. A public relations employee was dispatched to communicate with family members about ill loved ones and the situation inside. COVID strike teams apply an emergency response model traditionally used in natural disasters like hurricanes and wildfires to combating outbreaks in long-term care facilities. Composed of about 8 to 10 members from local emergency management departments, health departments, nonprofit organizations, private businesses, and at times the National Guard, the teams are designed to bring more resources and personnel to a disaster scene. Calling emergency management made sense because it was a disaster, said Dr. Anna Hicks, a local geriatrician who helped coordinate the Cherry Springs strike team. It felt like being in a natural disaster. COVID-19 outbreaks spread like wildfires in long-term care facilities, which house medically vulnerable residents and staff in relatively small spaces. So a growing number of states are treating them like one. More than 40% of all coronavirus deaths in the United States have been tied to nursing homes, according to a New York Times analysis. Desperate times, like a pandemic, call for a different way of thinking, said Dr. Timothy Chismar, the Emergency Medical Services Director for Maryland. The idea has roots in trauma settings where it's just not possible to take everybody off the scene. Sometimes you need to take some medical care to them. Though initially coordinated at the top, with governors and state health departments sending the National Guard to the scene, strike teams are now being replicated on a much smaller scale in counties and local jurisdictions, including in states that were hotspots for the virus, like North Carolina. At least 7 other states have sent strike teams to long-term care facilities with outbreaks, including Florida, Texas, Massachusetts, New Jersey, Ohio, Wisconsin, and Tennessee. other states have proposed but not yet adopted them. A bill in the House of Representatives introduced by members of both parties would allow the Secretary of the Department of Health and Human Services to allocate federal funds to the states specifically for the creation of strike teams to manage COVID-19 outbreaks in nursing homes. Understaffing has long plagued long-term care facilities in the United States, and the coronavirus pandemic has put the issue under a microscope. Representative Josh Gontemir, Democrat of New Jersey, one of the sponsors of the House bill, began coordinating strike teams in his state in April after receiving calls about outbreaks at two nursing homes in his district, where long-term care facilities were particularly hard hit by the virus. Police had discovered 17 bodies stuffed into a morgue that was only intended to hold four people inside Andover, Subicut, and Rehabilitation Center 1 and 2, one of the largest nursing homes in the state. The city's police chief said facility employees were simply overwhelmed by the amount of people who were expiring. An outbreak at the New Jersey Veterans Home at Paramus, a state-run home for former military members, had quickly evolved into one of the biggest coronavirus outbreaks in the country. Almost every resident, 98%, contracted the virus, and 81 people died. We quickly learned they had a massive staff outage. 60% of the staff were out sick, said Mr. Gontemir, who went on to coordinate strike teams statewide alongside Governor Phil Murphy, the Federal Coronavirus Task Force, Representative William Pascrell, and the National Guard in local hospitals. We called the other nursing homes in my district and found similar shortages, he said. And that's when it struck me that we better figure out a way to get more people on the ground to these facilities. The needs of long-term care residents are much greater during an outbreak, as previously healthy people may suddenly require complex medical attention, like oxygen concentrators and intravenous drips, or need assistance carrying out basic tasks like eating and drinking. The situation can be particularly dire for assisted living facilities, which tend to have fewer on-site medical staff than nursing homes, but are often home to people at risk for the worst outcomes of the virus, including those with developmental disabilities and dementia. But even nursing homes in general are not built for a whole lot of acute care, Dr. Chismar said. They serve a very important role, but that's just not part of their mission. Members of strike teams can help meet these needs by acting as temporary staff in the initial days of an outbreak. In most states, receiving strike team aid is voluntary. A long-term care facility requests the help of a team. The model has proliferated quickly. In North Carolina, Buncombe County adopted the strike team model shortly after seeing it implemented in neighboring Henderson County. The team conducts regular calls with long-term care facilities to aid with testing and infection control. But occasionally, they'll do drop-in visits to facilities they haven't heard from in a while, said Jennifer Mullendore, medical director at the Buncombe County Health Department. If there's a facility we have a concern about or we might have gotten a complaint about, or they show up on our radar for whatever reason, we will give the 15-minute heads up and ask to be let in, she said. Maryland, one of the first states to adopt this model, received more than 130 requests from nursing homes, assisted living facilities, and group homes for individuals with developmental disabilities in the first few months of the pandemic. 10 people, about a fifth of the residents, died at Cherry Springs Village over the course of its two-month outbreak. Henderson County officials believe outcomes would have been much worse without the help of the Rapid Response Strike Team. But more research is needed about this and other strategies for combating COVID-19 outbreaks in nursing homes and congregate care facilities. Anecdotally, we've seen that facilities who have had cases since April, when we first started using the strike team, have had slower, more controlled spread within their facilities, said Dr. Hicks, noting that the county has since sent the team to five other long-term care homes with outbreaks. We have definitely seen improved coordination of care and better control of the spread in these facilities. I don't think anyone knows 100% that strike teams are the reason for that, but I know they've been helpful. While there is no solid data how effective these strike teams have been, Cheryl Zimmerman, researcher and director of the Program on Aging, Disability, and Long-Term Care at the University of North Carolina, said they make sense. We do know that assisted living facilities in particular are understaffed and lack the medical expertise a nursing home would have, so it's critical to bring in outside help, she said. Taking this as an opportunity to embrace new models to provide support these places need is kind of a slam dunk, no-brainer. Mr. Gothmere, the New Jersey congressman who introduced the bill to provide federal funds for strike teams, said he wanted the option to be available in states now facing a surge in cases and hospitalizations. Unfortunately, other parts of the country are now experiencing what we did and having massive shortages overall of healthcare staff, said Gothmere. We saw how critical strike teams were in the crisis here. You're always hopeful strike teams won't be needed, but the point is to have them ready in case we do. Now, this is our second article we'll read from the New York Times. Federal study of COVID treatments enters a new phase. A clinical trial showed that remdesivir helped hospitalized patients. Now, researchers are asking whether, when the drug is paired with another antiviral drug, patients will recover faster. A large federal study that found an antiviral drug, remdesivir, can hasten the recovery in hospitalized COVID-19 patients has begun a new phase of investigation. Now it will determine whether adding another drug, beta interferon, which mainly kills viruses but can also tame inflammation, would improve remdesivir's effects and speed recovery even more. So far, remdesivir, an experimental drug, has received emergency use approval from the Food and Drug Administration to treat hospitalized COVID patients. In a large clinical trial sponsored by the National Institutes of Health, remdesivir was shown to modestly shorten recovery time by 4 days on average, but it did not reduce deaths. The additional drug, beta interferon, has already been approved for treatment of multiple sclerosis, which takes advantage of its anti-inflammatory effect. The U.S. trial, known as ACCT, is designed to move quickly. Known as an adaptive trial, it is a race between treatments. It tests one treatment against another, and when the results are in, the drug that won that phase becomes the control drug for the next phase, in which it is tested against a different drug. The new phase is the study's third. A total of 1,000 patients will receive either remdesivir and a placebo, or remdesivir and beta interferon. Interferon is given as an injection. Remdesivir, made by Gilead Sciences, is given an intravenous infusion. A team of researchers held multiple group conference calls trying to select the new test drug for phase three. Dr. Peter Chin Hong, an infectious disease expert at the University of California in San Francisco, said. Their first suggestion was to try adding an experimental drug made by Merck, known as EIDD-2801, which, like remdesivir, is an antiviral, but is a pill. But they wanted something that had already been approved and available for other diseases. They hoped that by showing that the new drug was effective and had already been approved for other illnesses, that doctors could immediately give it to COVID patients. The group also considered dexamethasone, a common steroid that seems to be effective in reducing the death rate in severely ill patients. The drug, which suppresses inflammation, might be even better when added to remdesivir, the researchers reasoned. But they worried. Dexamethasone is inexpensive and easily available. With widespread publicity over its apparent effectiveness, many patients would balk at joining a study in which they might get a placebo. Then the group weighed using beta interferon, which had several things going for it. It is on the market as a treatment for multiple sclerosis because of its weak anti-inflammatory properties. It kills the new coronavirus in laboratory studies, and it kills SARS and MERS, which are also coronaviruses. And most impressive, Dr. Chin Hong said, the drug was tested twice in COVID patients with promising results. One test was in England, where beta interferon or a placebo was provided to 101 hospitalized patients. They inhaled it in a nebulizer, a device like the ones used to deliver asthma medications. The study, although small, found that those who had received the drug recovered better than those who had received the placebo. The other study in Hong Kong involved 127 patients who received beta interferon, along with two antiviral drugs. The patients were hospitalized, but many were not severely ill. The drug cocktail was superior to placebo in speeding recovery. But the U.S. trial will be the only large, rigorous trial to test beta interferon in COVID patients. The first phase involving remdesivir began on February 21st, testing the experimental drug against the placebo. That phase closed on April 19th, after 1,000 patients had been enrolled. The National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, which is sponsoring the study, announced preliminary results on April 27th. The next phase began on May 8th, testing remdesivir and a placebo against remdesivir and baricitinib, an arthritis drug that quells inflammation. Researchers hoped that the addition of the arthritis drug would improve patients' outcomes by stemming an overreaction of the immune system to the virus, a so-called cytokine storm, which can occur in severely ill patients and can be lethal. After 1,000 patients were enrolled and followed, that part of the study was closed. Results of phase 2 are still being evaluated. Dr. Chin Hong said that he and the others were fairly certain that if adding the arthritis drug, baricitinib, were found to have helped at all, the effect would not have been huge. If the drug had demonstrated an impressive effect, the study's Data Safety and Monitoring Board, which oversees the trial, would have halted it and given every patient remdesivir and baricitinib. That combination would then have been the control drugs for phase 3 in the study. That did not happen. Rather than wait while the data with baricitinib could be fully evaluated, the study has moved on to its next phase, testing remdesivir and placebo against remdesivir and beta interferon. Enrollment began this month. At the University of California in San Francisco and San Francisco General, 9 patients have joined so far. We are approaching another today, Dr. Chin Hong said on Monday. Our third article, also from the New York Times. Scientists see signs of lasting immunity to COVID-19, even after mild infections. New research indicates that the human immune system cells are storing information about the coronavirus so they can fight it off again. To the immune system, not all germs are equally memorable, but our body's cells seems to be seriously studying up on the coronavirus. Scientists who have been monitoring immune responses to the virus are now starting to see encouraging signs of strong, lasting immunity, even in people who developed only mild symptoms of COVID-19, a flurry of new studies suggests. Disease-fighting antibodies, as well as immune cells called B cells and T cells that are capable of recognizing the virus, appear to persist months after infections have resolved, an encouraging echo of the body's enduring response to other viruses. Things are really working as they're supposed to, said Deepta Bhattacharya, an immunologist at the University of Arizona and an author of one of the new studies, which has not yet been peer-reviewed. Although researchers cannot forecast how long these immune responses will last, many experts consider the data a welcome indication that the body's most studious cells are doing their job and will have a good chance of fending off the coronavirus faster and more fervently than before if exposed to it again. This is exactly what you would hope for, said Marion Pepper, an immunologist at the University of Washington and an author on another of the new studies, which is currently under review at the journal Nature. All the pieces are there to have a totally protective immune response. Protection against reinfection cannot be fully confirmed until there is proof that most people who encounter the virus a second time are actually able to keep it at bay, Dr. Pepper said. But the findings could help quell recent concerns over the virus's ability to dupe the immune system into amnesia, leaving people vulnerable to repeat bouts of the disease. Researchers have yet to find unambiguous evidence that coronavirus reinfections are occurring, especially within the few months that the virus has been rippling through the human population. The prospect of immune memory helps to explain that, Dr. Pepper said. In discussions about immune responses to the coronavirus, much of the conversation has focused on antibodies, Y-shaped proteins that can latch onto the surfaces of pathogens and block them from infecting cells. But antibodies represent just one wing of a complex and coordinated squadron of immune soldiers, each with their own unique modes of attack. Viruses that have already invaded cells, for instance, are cloaked from antibodies, but are still vulnerable to killer T cells, which force infected cells to self-destruct. Another set of T cells, nicknamed helpers, can coax B cells to mature into antibody-making machines. Yet another sector of the immune system assails pathogens within minutes of their arrival, while sending out signals called cytokines to mobilize forces from elsewhere in the body. Some evidence suggests that severe cases of COVID-19 may stem from this early process going awry. Antibodies also come with an expiration date because they are inanimate proteins and not living cells. They can't replenish themselves and so disappear from the blood just weeks or months after they are produced. Hordes of antibodies appear shortly after a virus has breached the body's barriers and then wane as the threat dissipates. Most of the B cells that produce these early antibodies die off as well. But even when not under siege, the body retains a battalion of longer-lived B cells that can churn out virus-fighting antibodies en masse, should they prove useful again. Some patrol in the bloodstream, waiting to be triggered anew. Others retreat into the bone marrow, generating small amounts of antibodies that are detectable years, sometimes decades, after an infection is over. Several studies, including those led by Dr. Bhattacharya and Dr. Pepper, have found antibodies capable of incapacitating the coronavirus, lingering at low levels in the blood months after people have recovered from COVID-19. The antibodies decline, but they settle in what looks like a stable nadir, which is observable about 3 months after symptoms start, Dr. Bhattacharya said. The response looks perfectly durable. Seeing antibodies this long after infection is a strong indication that B cells are still chugging away in the bone marrow, Dr. Pepper said. She and her team were also able to pluck B cells that recognize the coronavirus from blood of people who have recovered from mild cases of COVID-19 and grow them in the lab. Multiple studies, including one published on Friday in the journal Cell, have also managed to isolate coronavirus-attacking T cells from the blood of recovered individuals, long after symptoms have disappeared. When provoked with bits of the coronavirus in the lab, these T cells pumped out virus-fighting signals and cloned themselves into fresh armies ready to confront a familiar foe. Some reports have noted that analyses of T cells could give researchers a glimpse into the immune response to the coronavirus, even in patients whose antibody levels have declined to a point where they are difficult to detect. This is really promising, said Smita Iyer, an immunologist at the University of California, Davis, who is studying immune responses to the coronavirus in rhesus macaques, but was not involved in the new studies. This calls for some optimism about herd immunity and potentially a vaccine. Notably, several of the new studies are finding these powerful responses in people who did not develop severe cases of COVID-19, Dr. Iyer added. Some researchers have worried that infections that take a smaller toll on the body are less memorable to the immune system's studious cells, which may prefer to invest their resources in more serious assaults. In some cases, the body could even jettison the viruses so quickly that it fails to catalog them. This paper suggests this is not true, Dr. Iyer said. You can still get durable immunity without suffering the consequences of infection. What has been observed in people who fought off mild cases of COVID-19 might not hold true for hospitalized patients whose bodies struggle to marshal a balanced immune response to the virus, or those who were infected but had no symptoms at all. Research groups around the world are continuing to study the entire range of responses, but the vast majority of the cases are these mild infections, said Jason Netland, an immunologist at the University of Washington and an author on the paper under review at Nature. If those people are going to be protected, that's still good. This new spate of studies could also further assuage fears about how and when the pandemic will end. On Friday, updated guidance released by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention was misinterpreted by several news reports that suggested immunity against the coronavirus might last only a few months. Experts quickly responded, noting the dangers of propagating such statements and pointing to the wealth of evidence that people who previously had the virus are probably at least partly protected from the reinfection for at least 3 months, if not much longer. Considered with other recent reports, the new data reinforced the idea that, yes, you do develop immunity to this virus, and good immunity to this virus, said Dr. Yun-Hyung Lee, an immunologist at Emory University, who was not involved in the studies. That's the message we want to get out there. Some illnesses, like the flu, can plague populations repeatedly, but that is at least partly attributable to the high mutation rates of influenza viruses, which can quickly make the pathogens unrecognizable to the immune system. Coronavirus, in contrast, tend to change their appearance less readily from year to year. Still, much remains unknown. Although these studies hint at the potential for protectiveness, they do not demonstrate protection in action, said Cheong-Hee Chang, an immunologist at the University of Michigan who was not involved in the new studies. It's hard to predict what's going to happen, Dr. Chang said. Humans are so heterogeneous. There are so many factors coming into play. Research in animals could help fill in a few gaps. Small studies have shown that one bout of the coronavirus seems to protect rhesus macaques from contracting it again. But tracking long-term human responses will take time, Dr. Pepper said. Good immune memory, she added, requires molecules and cells to be abundant, effective, and durable. And scientists cannot yet say that all three conditions have been definitively met. As people's bodies settle into their post-coronavirus state, we're just now hinting the point of relevance to take the long view on immunity, Dr. Bhattacharya said. Things may change a few months or years down the line, or they may not. There's no shortcuts here, Dr. Bhattacharya said. We just have to follow it out. And now our fourth article relates to the previous article. What if herd immunity is closer than scientists thought? In what may be the world's most important math puzzle, researchers are trying to figure out how many people in a community must be immune before the coronavirus fades. We've known from the beginning how the end will arrive. Eventually, the coronavirus will be unable to find enough susceptible hosts to survive, fading out wherever it briefly emerges. To achieve so-called herd immunity, the point at which the virus can no longer spread widely because there are not enough vulnerable humans, scientists have suggested that perhaps 70% of a given population must be immune through vaccination or because they survived the infection. Now some researchers are wrestling with a hopeful possibility. In interviews with the New York Times, more than a dozen scientists said that the threshold is likely to be much lower, just 50%, perhaps even less. If that's true, then it may be possible to turn back the coronavirus more quickly than once thought. The new estimates result from complicated statistical modeling of the pandemic, and the models have all taken divergent approaches, yielding inconsistent estimates. It is not certain that any community in the world has enough residents now immune to the virus to resist a second wave. But in parts of New York, London, and Mumbai, for example, it is not inconceivable that there is already substantial immunity to the coronavirus, scientists said. I'm quite prepared to believe that there are pockets in New York City and London which have substantial immunity, said Bill Hanage, an epidemiologist at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health. What happens this winter will reflect that. The question of what it means for the population as a whole, however, is more fraught, he added. Herd immunity is calculated from the epidemic's so-called reproductive number, RO, an indicator of how many people each infected person spreads the virus to. The initial calculations for the herd immunity threshold assumed that each community member had the same susceptibility to the virus and mixed randomly with everyone else in the community. That doesn't happen in real life, said Dr. Saad Omer, director of the Yale Institute for Global Health. Herd immunity could vary from group to group, and subpopulation to subpopulation, and even by postal codes, he said. For example, a neighborhood of older people may have little contact with others, but succumb to the virus quickly when they encounter it, whereas teenagers may bequeath the virus to dozens of contacts and yet stay healthy themselves. The virus moves slowly in suburban and rural areas where people live far apart, but zips through cities and households thick with people. Once such real-world variations in density and demographics are accounted for, the estimates for herd immunity fall. Some researchers even suggested the figure may be in the range of 10 to 20%, but they were in the minority. Assuming the virus ferrets out the most outgoing and most susceptible in the first wave, immunity following a wave of infection is distributed more efficiently than with a vaccination campaign that seeks to protect everyone, said Tom Britton, a mathematician at Stockholm University. His model puts the threshold for herd immunity at 43%. That is, the virus cannot hang on in a community after that percentage of residents has become infected and recovered. Still, that means residents of the community will have been sickened or have died, a high price to pay for herd immunity. And experts like Dr. Hanage cautioned that even a community that may have reached herd immunity cannot afford to be complacent. The virus may still flare up here and there, even if its overall spread is stymied. It's also unclear how long someone who has recovered may be immune, and for how long. Virus-resistant communities? The coronavirus crashed this year's Purim celebrations in the Orthodox Jewish neighborhoods of New York City, tearing through the parades and masquerades in Brooklyn on March 9th and 10th. Schools and synagogues soon shut down to quell the spread, but it was too late. By April, thousands in the Brooklyn communities were infected and hundreds had died. It was like a black hole in my memory because of how traumatic it was, said Blimey Marcus, a nurse practitioner who lives in Borough Park, which was hit hard by the virus. But all that has changed now, Ms. Marcus added. The general feeling is one of complacency, that somehow we've all had it and we're safe. Is it possible that some of these communities have herd immunity? In some clinics, up to 80% of people tested had antibodies to the virus. The highest prevalence was found among teenage boys. But people at clinics are more likely to be showing symptoms and therefore more likely to be infected, said Wan Hang, an epidemiologist at Columbia University's Mailman School of Public Health in New York. Random household surveys would probably find lower rates, but still well above the 21% average reported for New York City, she said. Researchers in Mumbai conducted just such a random household study, knocking on every fourth door, or if it was locked, the fifth, and took blood for antibody testing. They found a startling disparity between the city's poorest neighborhoods and its more affluent enclaves. Between 51 and 58% of residents in poor areas had antibodies, versus 11 to 17% elsewhere in the city. The lowest income residents are packed tightly together, share toilets, and have little access to masks. These factors contributed to a silent infection spread, said Dr. Jayanthi Shastri, a microbiologist at Kasturba Hospital in Mumbai, who led the work. Most researchers are wary of concluding that the hardest-hit neighborhoods of Brooklyn, or even those in blighted areas of Mumbai, have reached herd immunity or will be spared future outbreaks. But models like Dr. Britton's hint that it's not impossible. Other researchers have suggested, controversially, that herd immunity can be achieved at rates of immunity as low as 10 or 20%, and that entire countries may already have achieved that goal. Criticism trailed Sunetra Gupta, a theoretical epidemiologist at Oxford University, after a widely circulated interview in which she said that London and New York may already have reached herd immunity because of variability among people, combined with the theoretical immunity to common cold coronaviruses that may protect against the new one. That could be the explanation for why you don't see a resurgence in places like New York, she said. Most experts reject that notion. Several studies have shown that certain immune cells produced following infection with seasonal coronaviruses may also recognize the new coronavirus. But where is the evidence that it's protective? Asked Natalie Dean, a biostatistician at the University of Florida. These cities have not returned to pre-pandemic levels of activity, other experts noted. We are still nowhere near back to normal in our daily behavior, said Virginia Pitzer, a mathematical epidemiologist at the Yale School of Public Health. To think that we can just stop doing all that and go back to normal and not see a rise in cases, I think is wrong, is incorrect. A second wave might also hit groups or neighborhoods that were spared by the first and still wreak havoc, she said. Immunity is a patchwork quilt in New York, for instance. Antibodies were present in 68% of people visiting a clinic in the Corona neighborhood of Queens, for instance, but in just 13% of those tested at a clinic in the Cobble Hill section of Brooklyn. But another group, led by the mathematician Gabriella Gomes of the University of Strathclyde in Britain, accounted for variations within a society in its model and found that Belgium, England, Portugal, and Spain have herd immunity thresholds in the range of 10 to 20%. At least in countries we applied it to, we could never get any signal that herd immunity thresholds are higher, Dr. Gomes said. I think it's good to have this horizon that it may be just a few more months of the pandemic. Other experts urged caution, saying these models are flawed, as all models are, and that they oversimplify conditions on the ground. Jeffrey Shanman, an epidemiologist at Columbia University, said it wasn't clear to him that Dr. Gomez's model offered only one possible solution, and he was suspicious of the big ranges among the four countries. I think we'd be playing with fire if we pretended we're done with this, Dr. Shanman said. The new models offer food for thought, he and other experts said, but should not be used to set policy. Mathematically, it's certainly possible to have herd immunity at these very, very low levels, said Carl Bergstrom, an infectious disease expert at the University of Washington in Seattle. Those are just our best guesses for what the numbers should look like. But, he added, they're exactly that, guesses. Imperfect immunity. But what about immunity at levels lower than those needed for herd immunity? Definitely the disease would not spread as well if it gets back into New York, said Joel Miller, a mathematical modeler at La Trobe University in Australia. The same level of behavior change will have more effect on the disease now than it did 4 months ago. Thinking of a city or country as composed of subgroups demarcated by age, race, and level of social activity might also help governments protect those with the least immunity. That perspective also might help put a renewed focus on groups who require the higher levels of immunity because of greater exposure levels and other inequities, including Black and Latino residents, said Dr. Manoj Jain, an infectious disease expert at Emory University. That's where this info is very useful, he said. The models also suggest a vaccination strategy. Rather than uniformly vaccinate all groups, governments could identify and immunize those most likely to be exposed in super spreader events. Getting those people vaccinated first can lead to the greatest benefit, said Dr. Michael Mina, an immunologist at Harvard University. That alone could lead to herd immunity. Vaccination schemes for other pathogens have successfully exploited this approach. For example, when children were given the pneumococcal vaccine in the early 2000s, rates of bacterial pneumonia in the elderly rapidly dropped because of a herd effect. Vaccines that offer just 50% protection are considered to be moderately effective. But at that efficiency, even a low herd immunity target would require that a large proportion of the population be immunized, Dr. Bergstrom noted. If there are early reports of side effects that may scare away some people, he said, we'd do well to start thinking about all that now. Back in Brooklyn, fewer than 1% of people tested at neighborhood clinics over the past 8 weeks were infected with the virus. But there are still handfuls of cases, Ms. Marcus said, adding that her 10-year-old niece was in quarantine because a counselor at her day camp had tested positive. Sometimes that's all you need, right? She said. I'm still hoping we don't see what we had in March and April, but I'm not so sure that we've seen the end of it. Our next article, also from the New York Times. Fearing a twindemic, health experts push urgently for flu shots. There's no vaccine for COVID-19, but there's one for influenza. With the season's first doses now shipping, officials are struggling over how to get people to take it. As public health officials look to fall and winter, the specter of a new surge of COVID-19 gives them chills. But there's a scenario they dread even more, a severe flu season, resulting in a twindemic. Even a mild flu season could stagger hospitals already coping with COVID-19 cases. And though officials don't yet know what degree of severity to anticipate this year, they are worried large numbers of people could forego flu shots, increasing the risk of widespread outbreaks. The condition about a twindemic is so great that officials around the world are pushing the flu shot even before it becomes available in clinics and doctor's offices. Dr. Robert Redfield, director of the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, has been talking it up, urging corporate leaders to figure out ways to inoculate employees. The CDC usually purchases 500,000 doses for uninsured adults, but this year ordered an additional 9.3 million doses. Dr. Anthony Fauci, director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, has been imploring people to get the flu shot, so that you could at least blunt the effect of one of those two potential respiratory infections. In Britain, Prime Minister Boris Johnson has been waging his own pro-flu shot campaign. Last month, he labeled people who oppose flu vaccines nuts and announced the country's largest ever rollout of shots. In April, one of the few reasons Australia allowed citizens to break the country's strict lockdown was to venture out for their flu shots. The flu vaccine is rarely mandated in the U.S., except by some healthcare facilities and nursery schools. But this month, the statewide University of California system announced that because of the pandemic, it is requiring all 230,000 employees and 280,000 students to get the flu vaccine by November 1st. A life-threatening respiratory illness that crowds emergency rooms and intensive care units, flu shares symptoms with COVID-19. Fever, headache, cough, sore throat, muscle aches, and fatigue. Flu can leave patients vulnerable to a harsher attack of COVID-19, doctors believe, and that coming down with both viruses at once could be disastrous. The 2019-2020 flu season in the United States was mild, according to the CDC, but a mild flu season still takes a toll. In preliminary estimates, the CDC says that cases ranged from 39 million to 56 million, resulting in up to 740,000 hospitalizations and from 24,000 to 62,000 flu-related deaths. According to the CDC, flu season occurs in the fall and winter, peaking from December to February, and so was nearing its end as the pandemic began to flare up in the United States in March. But now, fighting flu proactively during the continuing pandemic presents significant challenges. Not only how to administer the shot safely and readily, but also how to prompt people to get a shot that a majority of Americans have typically distrusted, dismissed, and skipped. With many places where the flu shot is administered en masse now inaccessible, including offices and plants that offered it free to employees on site and school health clinics, officials have been reaching out to local health departments, healthcare providers, and corporations to arrange distribution. From now through October 31st, publicity campaigns will blast through social media, billboards, television, and radio. Because the shot will be more difficult to access this year, people are being told to get it as soon as possible, although immunity does wane. There will be flu shot tents with heaters in parking lots and pop-up clinics in empty school buildings. Because of the efforts, vaccine makers are projecting that a record 98 million flu shots will be given this year in the United States, about 15% more than doses ordered last year. The Kaiser Permanente Healthcare System will be flooding more than 12 million of its members with flu shot reminders via postcard, email, text, and phone calls. Pharmacies and even supermarkets are expected to play a bigger role than they have in previous years. As of this week, Walgreens and CVS will have flu shots available. Walgreens will be hosting additional off-site flu vaccine clinics in community centers and churches. To reduce contact time, CVS is allowing patients to fill out paperwork digitally. In New York City, which averages about 2,000 flu-related deaths a year, the health department has been reaching out to hundreds of independent pharmacies to administer the shots, because they are often located in outer borough neighborhoods where the coronavirus has been rampaging. The health department has a detailed online flu vaccine locator. Access is a problem for all adult vaccines, said L.J. Tan, chief strategy officer for the Immunization Action Coalition, a nonprofit group that works to increase vaccination rates, who was an early promoter of the term twindemic. Adults may think, if I can get the flu shot easily, I might consider it. But as difficult as getting the flu shot to people safely will be, perhaps harder still will be persuading them to actually get it. In the 2018-19 flu season in the United States, only 45.3% of adults over 18 got the vaccine, with rates for those ages 18 to 50 considerably lower. Skepticism to this vaccine runs high, particularly in communities of color, because of long-standing distrust and discrimination in public health. A 2017 study in the journal Vaccine noted that compared with white people, African Americans were more likely to report barriers to vaccination, were more hesitant about vaccines in general, and the flu vaccine specifically, more likely to believe in conspiracy theories, and use naturalism as an alternative to getting vaccinated. Across all demographic groups, perhaps the most striking reason given for avoiding the flu vaccine is that people do not see it as efficacious as, say, the measles vaccine. Indeed, it is a good vaccine, but not a great one. It must be repeated annually. Immunity takes up to 2 weeks to kick in. But its efficacy also depends on how accurately infectious disease centers worldwide forecast which strains are expected to circulate in the coming year, and then those strains can mutate. Although the flu shot confers immunity at all ages over 6 months, it can be less complete in people over 65. Depending on many factors, the shot's effectiveness in a given year can range from 40 to 60%. But a vaccine not given won't protect anyone, said Dr. Jane R. Zucker, Assistant Commissioner for the Bureau of Immunization at the New York City Health Department, which has been hosting webinars for providers about how to have conversations about the flu shot with hesitant patients. As health officials note, should a vaccinated person contract the flu, the severity will almost certainly be reduced, hospitalization rarely necessary. Especially with COVID-19 raging, public officials reason those odds look pretty good. Another reason people give for not getting the shot is they think it makes them sick. People who say, "I'll never get it because it gives me the flu," have not had the flu and don't know what it is, said Patsy Stinchfield, Senior Director of Infection Prevention at Children's Minnesota. "What you're feeling is your body's immune response to the virus's antigens," says Ms. Stinchfield, a member of the CDC's influenza work group. "You may feel flu-ish, and that's a good thing. It's your body's way of saying, I am ready for the flu, and I won't get as sick if I get the real one." Public campaigns will describe the shot as a critical weapon during the pandemic. Hopefully, people will say, "There's no COVID vaccine, so I can't control that, but I do have access to the flu vaccine, and I can get that," Ms. Stinchfield said. "It gives you a little power to protect yourself." Other campaigns will emphasize familial and community responsibility. Usually, flu vaccine compliance rates among people ages 18 to 49 are low. Vermont's, for example, is only about 27%. Christine Finley, the state's immunization program manager, believes that rates will improve because of the pandemic's stay-at-home households. People are more aware that the risks they take can negatively impact others, she said. They're often taking care of young children and older parents. If any example could prove instructive about protective behavior and flu vaccines during the coronavirus epidemic, it could well be Australia. Australia's flu vaccine rates tends to be modest, but this year, demand was high. The government's rollout of the shot began earlier than usual for the June through August winter because the coronavirus pandemic was exploding, though the government had also issued strict no-entry limits among many states and territories and bans on international travel, the flu shot was one of the few reasons people could emerge from lockdown. The prevalent strain circulating in the country is type A, the most common and virulent form of flu, said Dr. Kelly L. Moore, a public health expert at the Vanderbilt University School of Medicine. According to the CDC, type A is the most likely to circulate globally. It mutates readily, particularly as it jumps between animals and humans. There are two strains of type A influenza in the vaccine, Dr. Moore said, and so the very best way to protect yourself is to get the shot. Reported cases of flu in Australia have dropped 99% compared with 2019. Australia's milder-than-usual flu season is likely the result of a number of factors. Strong flu vaccination uptake, social distancing, but also severely decreased movement of people, said Dr. Jonathan Anderson, a spokesman for Seqirus, a supplier of flu vaccine. But though American public health authorities usually look to Australia's flu season as a predictive, Australians say this year it's not a reliable indicator. This situation is of no comfort as these measures do not apply to the United States, where the populace has never been effectively physical distancing, nor have the country's entry restrictions been as onerous, said Dr. Paul Van Booyender, a public health professor at Griffith University in Queensland, Australia. All that Americans can do is get vaccinated against flu, he added, because circulation of the coronavirus remains high. It is likely they will have a significant influenza season this northern winter, he said. And that is your coronavirus update for this Wednesday, August 19th, 2020, from the Recording Library of West Texas. We'll bring you the national and international news next with USA Today, and then at 3 o'clock, your local news. And here are some of the articles that our volunteers will be reading. From the Midland Reporter-Telegram, MISD may not need as much at-home learning. MISD board to continue Riddick's evaluation. Feeding America CEO visits West Texas Food Bank. Planning and zoning OK's Bentonbaugh plan for smaller lots and houses. From the Odessa American, initiative to include Midland Memorial. Family Health Clinic celebrates 25 years. UTPB hosting drive-through graduation. Man charged with shooting firearm in air in central Odessa. And new devices coming to ECISD campuses. Those articles and more at 3 o'clock. At 6 o'clock, we'll bring you the Wall Street Journal. And then at 7 o'clock tonight, we'll bring you our Centers Solutions podcast that is hosted by our executive director of the Recording Library, Bailey Hennis, as well as the CEO of Centers for Family and Children, Christy Edwards, and then Melanie Seiss, also of Centers for Family and Children. They have an interesting interview this week with Shelby Hammer, who is the head of the Trinity School in Midland. And they will be discussing about back to school, how Trinity in particular is handling bringing kids in back to school this year, and then back to school in general. That coming up at 7 o'clock. Next on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, USA Today. Followed by the Midland Reporter Telegram and Odessa American at 3. Recording Library of West Texas produces weekly podcasts in association with Centers. Join Centers Dr. Christy Edwards and licensed therapist Melanie Seiss, along with your host, Recording Library's Executive Director, Bailey Hennis, as they feature guests and discuss how to cope in the age of COVID-19. These programs present information about mental health and include tips on dealing with anxiety, isolation, worry, and more. Topics include mental exercises you can practice to become calm and relaxed, ideas on things to do during this time, information specific to seniors, and other related topics. The Center's COVID-19 podcasts, Tuesdays at 11 a.m., Wednesdays at 7 p.m., and Fridays at 5 a.m. on Recording Library of West Texas Radio. You can also access these podcasts on demand at centerstx.org.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 92 and clear. Tonight, partly cloudy with a low in the low 80s. Then, tomorrow, mostly cloudy with a high in the mid-90s. Tomorrow night, clear with a low in the low 80s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
Coronavirus updates, weekdays at 1.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 2 p.m.
Hello, this is Melanie, and I'm reading articles from the USA Today, Wednesday, August 19th, 2020. Starting with the money section under the money line column. First item, Walmart's second quarter sales exceeded expectations. Walmart's online sales nearly doubled in the fiscal second quarter, and at Walmart stores, sales at U.S. locations opened at least a year jumped 9.3%, the company reported on Tuesday. Walmart topped almost all expectations by wide margins. Second item, FedEx to put surcharges on holiday packages. FedEx will have surcharges on certain home deliveries and packages it hands off to the U.S. Postal Service during the holiday shipping season, the company announced Tuesday. FedEx's residential delivery charge on certain U.S. Express and U.S. Ground services runs from November 2nd to January 17th of 2021. And the last item in that column, Payless returns with new name and a new website. Payless is back in